Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists share the most recent work. I am Joseph, and today I had a terrific conversation with none other than Dr. Brian Nosek. Brian is currently the co-founder and executive director for the Center for Open Science, with a mission to increase the openness, integrity, and reproducibility of scientific research. Brian led the landmark Reproducibility Project and many more since then, which have provoked deep discussions, reflections, and reforms in the way psychological studies are conducted to this day. Brian is also a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, where he runs the Implicit Social Cognition Lab that investigates aspects of our attitudes that influence our judgments and our behavior. Without further ado, let's get to it. Brian Nosek, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. I'm really excited for today's discussion because we're going to explore the behind the scenes of how science is conducted and the challenges involved in the process. So Brian, the title of your review is Replicability, Robustness, and Reproducibility in Psychological Science. I'll note that there's a non-trivial number of authors on this one, 16 to be exact. And Brian, we have listeners with all sorts of backgrounds. So I'd like us to begin by providing a little bit of context. In the last decade, psychological science has been embroiled in this reckoning, which some have called a crisis or even an opportunity. Can you briefly summarize this historical background before we get to your annual review paper?
Yeah, and there's, of course, lots and lots of historical background one can summarize. So I'll summarize it one way, and we'll see if we want to talk about it in others. The way that I often think about this is in terms of what is it that the system does as a social system for acquiring knowledge, and where does the system encourage us as individual researchers practicing our research to do things that advance the credibility of our work versus do things that actually might undermine the credibility of our work. So to make that a little bit more concrete, the concerns about reproducibility or replicability come in part from observation that researchers are rewarded for producing certain kinds of results. So we are all in our careers and trying to get jobs and keep jobs and get grants and everything else. And the primary reward currency is publication, right? You publish as much as you can in the most prestigious places that you can publish. And people that are successful at publishing tend to get some of the other rewards, right? The more likely to get more publications, more likely to get grants, more likely to get a job, et cetera. And so in that context, you could say, well, yeah, part of that is exactly reasonable, right? People who produce knowledge and find things are ones who get rewarded in the system. But as we know, not everything gets published, right? Some things are more likely to get published than other things. So I'm more likely to publish for a positive result than a negative result. More likely to get published for a novel finding rather than repeating something that someone else has claimed previously. More likely to get published if I have neat and tidy findings, everything fitting together, and things that don't quite fit. So in that context, then there is an interest for me to get certain kinds of results in order to be published. And the one thing that we're not supposed to control in our research are the results. What we control is the ideas, the questions that we investigate, the methodologies that we use to investigate those things. And the results are the results. But if the reward system is about the results, then we put ourselves in a conflict of interest that what I am rewarded for will be contingent on whether I get the results that are rewarding. I need to get these certain kinds of things. So that's the big context where concerns about this came up. And lots of scholars in the 1960s and 70s talked about practices in a more concrete way in the research process that might actually challenge replicability and reproducibility. So Tony Greenwald published a paper called Prejudice Against the Null Hypothesis. Jacob Cohen talked about underpowered research. Paul Meehl talked about challenges and theories that aren't really testable or advanceable in any particular way, not cumulative evidence. Bob Rosenthal talked about the file drawer effect and publication bias, how we ignore negative results. And all of the things they talked about were potentially a consequence of this broader system of rewards. And all of them had consequences for the credibility of the findings that we ultimately publish. If we're ignoring negative results and only publishing positive results, then our literature will be exaggerations of reality. If we never do replications and we only publish novel findings, then we don't have any verification or self-correction process in the system that helps us to sort out things we know and don't, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all of this is too long of an answer for what you were asking, but the broader point is that we may have set up a system that creates friction for obtaining credible findings. And because we don't practice replication on an ongoing basis, we don't really know how credible a lot of our findings are in terms of their replicability. Replicability is not the only thing. There's also validity and other aspects of importance of the findings and claims. But that is a basic one that we don't have good evidence about, but we could have good evidence about.
Thank you for that comprehensive recap. So we've been using these terminologies, which are quite a mouthful. So replicability, robustness, and reproducibility. Would you please take a stab at clarifying the meanings of these words? Because they do seem to be related, but they're technically not synonyms.
Sure. And there's variation in how these terms are defined. And so that varies across fields and just across applications. As we're getting more familiar with these issues, there is emerging consensus on how to define them. But in the context of this paper, we adopted what is close to what recent National Academies committee suggested as how these terms should be used. And reproducibility in that context refers to taking the same data and applying the same analysis strategy as had been done previously and seeing if you get the same result. So in principle, research based on data and applying analysis should be 100% reproducible, right? They say that they analyzed the data, they found this. Did they? Like, can we just check? That should always occur. Robustness is taking the same data that someone else had used for a finding and then applying alternative analysis strategies to test the same question. So you'd use this exclusion rule. I want to try it with this other exclusion rule. You transformed your data this way. I want to try transforming it this other way. And we see if we get to the same result, despite us having different analytic strategies to try to answer the question, because there's lots of choices that one can make. So robustness would refer to how consistently do you see the same result with variations in reasonable alternative analysis strategies to apply to the same data. Replicability is, let's test the same question, but with a new set of data. You found it in that data set. I have a new data set, I think can test the same question as you tested. So I apply this data to see if we come to the same conclusions with novel data.
Brian, why should we want our studies to be replicable? Why can't it just be that a researcher conducts an experiment which yields a finding, which happens to be true for that specific sample at that time? And perhaps if the same experiment were run again in the future, of course, with a different sample, then the results would also be different. Why are we instead preoccupied with making sure that studies are reliable, that is, that they consistently produce the same result over multiple trials?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it depends really on the claim that one is trying to make. So if you are making a historical claim, right, these people did this one thing at this one point in time, and that doesn't tell us anything about psychology in general or won't apply in any other circumstances, then you may not be so concerned with replicability. But replicability does become a greater concern when the claims are trying to make some statement about irregularities in the world. Under these conditions, this type of thing occurs. And most of the research that's done in our field has an interest in saying something that applies more generally than just to the events that occurred in that particular experimental setting. And so the question of replicability is about that claim. What is it that you said you learned from this that could apply in other circumstances? And in that context, if the finding is not replicable, meaning it never applies in circumstances that you say it should apply in, then it's no longer really a regularity about the world. It's a potentially just a, something that happened that one time, if it even happened that time, right? Given measurement error and sampling error and everything else. But that's the main context in which we would care about replicability as a concept.
In this paper, one of the things you did was to attempt to figure out the proportion of findings in psychology that are replicable. This is not a trivial task, so I was hoping you could explain how you and your team went about it. You did note that psychology as a field is huge, it's interdisciplinary, and it's dynamic. So how do you know that your estimate reasonably captures the relevant literature, published or otherwise? And while we're on this point, perhaps you can give us a quick rundown of what you found. How many of our studies are failing to replicate?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the short answer is you can't establish what the replicability is of the entire field, because it is, too, as you said, it is huge. It's always changing. And there aren't any really clear defined boundaries of what counts as psychology and what isn't psychology, right? There's a lot of gray area where it would cross into what you would characterize as other disciplinary areas or otherwise. But of course, that's sort of a flippant answer. Like, oh yeah, so there's nothing we can learn about replicability of findings. I don't believe that. I think there is stuff that we can learn, but it ends up being constrained to whatever is the sampling strategy that we apply for a particular set of studies. So one example is the project that we did and completed in 2015 called the Reproducibility Project in Psychology. So this was an attempt to replicate findings from 100 papers published in three journals that there are issues that came out in 2008, mostly social and cognitive studies and a few other subdomains in psychology mixed in, and to see if we could, you know, reproduce the findings in those. And this is a big collaboration, 270 co-authors on the final paper. And in that effort, depending, there's multiple ways. It's actually hard to decide whether you successfully replicate something or not. So we had multiple criteria that you could use. And across the criteria, you would say that around 40% of the findings that we tried to replicate successfully replicated in that attempt. And so how widely does that apply? Well, I don't know. It depends on what you think of the overall sampling strategy. We tried to minimize selection bias, right? We defined a sample, tried to replicate as many of the findings that we could in that. But even in that effort, which was extensive, not every finding was replicated. We tried one finding from each paper. That's a limitation. We couldn't replicate every single finding, right? There were studies in there of, you know, longitudinal study of 10,000 people from the Netherlands tracked over 20 years. We're not going to do a replication of that. There's no way. So there are factors that change the set of studies that we were able to replicate from what would be a perfectly random sample. But nevertheless, this is what we found in the context of whatever the limitations are potentially of the of selection biases that we can only speculate on. And so it would be too far to say that replication rate characterizes psychology in general, or even those journals in general. But a reasonable benchmark is against what our expectation is of replicability from articles published around that time in those kinds of journals, right? Is 40%, to oversimplify, is that above or below what we think it ought to be or what we expected it to be? And those are the questions I think that we're wrestling with as a community is, okay, this is what we found given this context. And there's lots of other replication projects like it that find different rates in different sampling conditions. Are these revealing results that are lower than what we expect or want in this context? And that's, to me, the main benchmark to evaluate whether this is evidence of, oh, there are places to improve, or nope, everything is just fine.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point you raised. And I actually really like this point that you made in the paper. So someone might expect that science should have a 100% perfect replication rate. And you many other co-authors gave us reason to believe that this shouldn't be the case necessarily. Could you talk a little bit about that, about what reasons there could be for some studies not replicating?
Right. No, it's an important issue because we don't really know what the right replicability rate should be, but we do make a case in the paper that it shouldn't be 100%. And the reason that it shouldn't be 100% is that what we're studying is hard. We're studying things we don't understand, and we're going to get things wrong a lot. That's pretty normal in science, especially in basic or fundamental research, right? Prior to application or rolling out in the community, that we're exploring, right? We're looking into things that we don't understand, and we're sort of mucking around and seeing what might be there, what might not be there. In that context, if we set ourselves an expectation of everything that we publish must be 100% replicable, then what we would set up as a expectation in the environment, right? What we'd be imposing on the culture is be super conservative. Don't try anything outside of things you're really confident in, because you'll get hammered, right? If it doesn't replicate, then you're a terrible researcher. And that would be stifling for what we really value out of especially that early stage work, right? Does the vaccine work? I want that to be really high confidence, right? But the early stage work on developing potential therapies for a vaccine, yeah, of course, lots of false starts. Just don't put it in my arm until you're confident. So the work that happens over the course of a research process, right? From very early stage exploration to we think we've got something to we think we understand something to I think we can apply this thing. We should have increasingly high expectations for replicability of those findings, in addition to validity and all of the other elements of evaluating it. But what the level should be, that's hard to say. So that's one answer, is to say, yeah, failing to replicate something isn't itself a problem. On the flip side is that line of reasoning does not then justify saying, so low replicability is fine. It says replicability should be at the rate it should be to maximize knowledge accumulation. But we should still be doing basic fundamental research with the highest level of rigor as possible. So we should always be striving for replicable findings. It's not that we can say, oh, because we'll have some things that fail, we should therefore be sloppy. No, of course not. We should be as rigorous as possible. And part of rigor is doing things that will promote replicability, promote validity, promote generalizability, and simultaneously, we'll fall short of that all the time. But as long as we're putting the most quality, best quality work we can do, given the context that we're in, then hopefully that will result in science operating as efficiently as it can.
So we have established that a substantial minority of psychological studies seem to replicate around 40%, roughly speaking. And we have also established that increasing replicability is a desirable goal for the field. So what can we do to address this problem? You've given a lot of recommendations in the manuscript for changes individual researchers could make in their daily practice. So maybe let's go over the most important ones, and then later on we can talk about the more overarching structural and cultural considerations.
Yeah, it's an important question. There's ongoing debate about which types of behaviors are ultimately more beneficial than costly to try to improve the overall replicability of our findings. And I think by and large, that has been super productive as debate, because it really pushes our thinking as a community on what does it mean to do rigorous research? What kind of claims are we trying to make? How do we understand the certainty around those claims? And then can we investigate whether these different proposed solutions actually yield what we would hope for them to yield? So for me, there are three things that get the sort of top of attention for me for interventions that I think would have the most positive impact overall. And there's lots of other things, but I focus on three. One is open materials, is that when I do my research, I should share with you as much as I can of the procedure, the protocol, the measures, the outcomes, all of the things that went into actually conducting the research. Not because that itself will increase replicability directly, but it will allow you to evaluate my research more effectively. Right. So its long-term impact on rigor and credibility is to facilitate self-correction, that instead of you needing to rely on just reading my paper as I wrote it and me saying what I think is the important parts of methodology, you can actually look at my methodology. You can experience it, right? You get the videos of how the experimental session ran, whatever. And then you could say, wait, you called it this, but I just noticed that you did this weird thing when you were running the experiment. I think you set up a confounder you didn't even recognize. Right? So that transparency and sharing of the materials, I think, enables you to critique, you to extend, you to build upon the work that I did in a way that long over multiple studies promotes rigor and credibility, right? Doesn't mean I'm going to solve replicability in my individual study just because I made all of my crappy work available to you, but it gives the opportunity for that self-corrective work to happen. The second is related to that is open data. So if I share with you the data that I generated, then in the same way, you can reanalyze it and see if I made a mistake or not, right? Just that basic reproducibility checks, right? That is a credibility enhancer in the sense of transparency being credibility enhancing. And then it also allows you to do that robustness testing. Well, I made these choices that I thought were reasonable in my analytic path. And you look at it and say, well, that's not really best practice for how you deal with reaction time data. I'm going to try it again with this other approach to see if it's robust to that. So it has the positive impact of evaluating the credibility of the findings as they were. And then the data can be reused or applied in other ways, right? Aggregated with other data to get more cumulative evidence about the findings. So that's a benefit net for data that can be shared publicly, right? You have to anonymize in our field a lot of stuff to do that. The last one, I think, is the most impactful potentially directly on replicability, and that is pre-registration. And there's sort of two parts of pre-registration that are important. One is pre-registration that the study exists, so that if I pre-register each of the studies that I do, well, I might do 15 experiments in this particular line of work and only publish four of them. And you would rightfully want to know what happened with those other 11. Like, did you just ignore all the negative results, or is there some bias in how you selected what got in or didn't get in? So addressing publication bias can mean that the aggregate level of evidence, if you can see everything that I did, then you can calibrate your confidence in my findings appropriately. And then the second part of pre-registration that can be a benefit is to make it very clear what was planned in advance and what was not planned in advance, what was discovered after the fact. Often this is called confirmatory versus exploratory research, or hypothesis generating research versus hypothesis testing research. There are variations in what those terms mean, but the basic of planned and unplanned is an important distinction, because a lot of our statistical inferences through the standard use of null hypothesis significance testing assume that you know how many tests were done and the decision choices that went into making those tests. So we can have more confidence in our statistical inferences by having planned them out in advance. And then the other benefit is that knowing what is unplanned versus planned helps to calibrate our confidence in these two types of research practice, right? And exploratory research is super important, because when I get my findings, right, most of my hypotheses are wrong. Oh, geez, okay, I thought that was going to happen. It didn't happen. But let's get into the data, and oh my gosh, look what happened here. And oh, this is interesting. And oh, what are all these exceptions? And that often will stimulate all kinds of new and interesting ideas and directions. But that is data contingent decision making. I'm interacting with my data in order to try to draw inferences from that data. And that almost always, not always always, but almost always will reduce our confidence in the statistical inferences that we might make from that. Right? We just have more uncertainty because I'm now interacting with my data and perhaps focusing on parts that are occurring based on chance. By being really clear which things were planned and which were unplanned, and then what factors went into the unplanned stuff, we can more appropriately calibrate the confidence in our claims. Now, all three of those examples, I can still do horrible research that is pre-registered and totally open and shared and is not replicable ultimately. But all of those practices facilitate, enable the potential for improved rigor and enable you to more appropriately evaluate my work, so that in the aggregate across time, we can improve credibility and rigor.
At the beginning of this chat, you briefly highlighted how the institutional features of science, like publishing incentives, various policies of academic journals, and just the overall culture. You talked about how all of these contribute in some way to the replication problem. Do you think that all we would need is to reform research practices at an individual level, or do you also see an opportunity to enact change from the top down, for example, by reimagining alternative ways of designing our institutions?
Yeah, the reform movement, as it has been evolving over the last 10 years in psychological science, but very much more broadly, but keeping our conversation focused on psychology, a lot of the activity has been grassroots activity. Researchers saying, oh, yeah, we can do this better. And here's an idea. And then other researchers saying, oh, yeah, it's a good idea. Let's do that. That's better. And then others saying, what are you talking about? That's crazy. We're not doing that. And blah, 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 blah. They have the active debates that one should have. So that's really good. But that grassroots movement can only go so far in shifting the norms of practice. And if the reward systems don't change and catch up, then inevitably there'll be regress from those changing practices to whatever it is that is rewarded, right? It's very hard to have systems where the rewards are distinct from the norms and have the norms be sustained. Ideally, you would want the norms of the community to be embodied in the reward systems, right? Them to be highly aligned so that the things that we value, that we want to be doing, that we're trying to do, are the things that are rewarded by, in this case, the journal for deciding what gets published, the funder for deciding what gets funded, and the institution for deciding who gets hired and who gets promoted, tenured, et cetera. So those are the three big picture areas where the reward system can be changed to make sure that it is aligned with the behaviors that we think are most important for doing the best science that we can do. And a big part of that culture change movement is to debate and consider and to apply changes at each of those different reward points so that they can be more consistent with the values that we have.
I'm curious about whether this problem is specific to psychological science. Do you have any insights about the state of replicability in related scientific disciplines? For example, there's physics, sociology, chemistry, or even biomedical research. Should we expect similar numbers, at least to the extent that these disciplines are similar? This could give some context into the problem, and perhaps we could even ask if there are things that other people are doing that we could benefit from.
No, it's a great question. And any field that's looked at whether they have challenges for reproducibility has found them. So it is not at all clear that there are some fields that are immune to these challenges. But there's also likely variation in the extent to which they are challenges. So let's first talk about the lack of immunity and then why we might see variation. One of the obvious elements is that the reward system is pretty similar across scholarly domains, right? Publication is the currency of advancement, whether you're a psychologist, a sociologist, a chemist, or a cardiologist or researcher. And so as a consequence, if the same kinds of things get rewarded, then the same types of behaviors will emerge to get those rewards. So there is a lot of similarity across fields as far as we've been able to ascertain it. And I've been involved now for many years in many of these kinds of committees in different disciplinary domains. And everyone can articulate these same challenges. Oh, yeah, that's a real challenge. There's a lot of resonance about the system of rewards and incentives. So that's where I think no one is immune in the sense that, yeah, if we're all rewarded in this way, we're all going to do things to get those rewards intentionally or unintentionally. Where there may be variation is in what's available in that particular methodology or scholarly community that can advance the credibility of the research. And there are some areas that have more benefits than others in terms of accumulating credible findings more effectively or efficiently. And we can even constrain that to within psychology rather than having to look to other fields. So this is now I'm more speculating here than have evidence to show it. But the observed variation that leads to this speculation is that areas that have an easy time acquiring data, like it's trivial to get more data, also tend to have more replicable findings. So in vision sciences, right, these phenomenon where they can investigate, basically you see the same within subject studies, and you can see the same phenomenon in every person they investigate. Those fields are really good at getting to credible findings quickly because they can run replications readily. Every person they run practically is a replication for this particular visual illusion or whatever it is. Whereas areas of research where data acquisition is really hard or expensive, like neuroimaging or infant research, then every data point is precious. And doing the same study again, oh my God, why would... No way. I can't afford that. I don't have time for that. How am I possibly going to advance my career? Or what's really the biggest sample that I can manage to do in this study? Because I also have to do the next study. Whereas in an area of research that draws on the national election study data set, right? It's a massive data set. Great. It's so big that I really have to work at it to get to imprecise findings because I can leverage massive samples and get to high precision quickly. So there's these kinds of variations of the style of work that may make it possible to be replicable and still do all of the things that are rewarded. It's where there's limits, right? I have a capacity constraint on doing the behaviors that would really advance credibility. I still need the rewards. So I'm going to have to do the things for awards. Now, I say all that with the caveat that this is still speculation. There is no formal investigation looking at variation across fields or across methodologies for what's more replicable than other things. But this is a constant area of interest because of exactly what you said is, can we learn from what other areas are doing that might help improve applicability? And I think the obvious and unhelpful answer is, yeah, let's collect more data. No, that's okay. Yeah, that's great. So we need more babies, and we need more babies to be cooperative, and we need them to be easier in the lab. Well, that may not help. But what it might help to identify is, boy, wouldn't it be great if we were able to do data collection with infants remotely so that we didn't have all that extra work of scheduling them, bringing them into the lab, managing their moods in the lab. Boy, if we could do it remotely through Zoom, then we might be able to get a lot more data more efficiently. And that's exactly what a project like Lookit is doing in developmental sciences, is trying to improve the methodology to lower the barrier to access to data that would have as a long-term consequence, increased power, more precision, more opportunity to do replicable work in a very challenging data collection context.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned this. So childrenhelpingscience.com, that's one word, is another online child research platform I know that has mushroomed over the course of the pandemic. So I'm in a developmental psychology lab, and Devo Research is going through this interesting episode with lots of research transitioning online in the past couple of years. And I was super excited because our lab, along with other collaborators led by Aaron Chewy, who's a third-year grad student with Professor Hugh Guan, released a Frontiers paper very recently where they compared data from developmental studies done in person before the pandemic with data from the online versions of the same studies. And basically, the effects were successfully replicated, which is, at the very least, encouraging to researchers who are skeptical of running online studies.
Yeah. So yeah, if we're to celebrate things that the pandemic did for us, it might be that it forced some reconsideration of how we could do data collection at a distance. So infant research may be, and long-term, a beneficiary of that. Another that I think in our field that might benefit from it long-term is group-based research, right? It was really hard for group researchers to bring people in, schedule at the same time, have all of the participants show up, manage the confederates. But to the extent that some of those methodologies can translate to a virtual group environment, wow, now there's a lot easier scheduling, there's a lot easier data management, a lot of things start to become easier that might facilitate doing more robust research practices. So that's not to say we shouldn't be bringing people into the lab, right? There's a lot of things that, and this has been a complaint in our field, is the move to just online data collection because it's easy. Then we stop doing the science of actual behavior. Of course, online behavior is behavior, but people mean that in-person, tactile interaction types of stuff. So we need that, but we need it with the resources we have available and to be able to do it as well as we can.
Yeah, I think an ideal situation would probably be having all the options, as many options as possible available to a researcher. If you want to do an in-person study, you could do that. If you want to do an online study, then you could design a study that's more ideal exactly. for an online platform.
Exactly. Yeah, this has been an ongoing thing in my lab and our history is to start with the question we want to answer and think about what is the ideal way we would answer that question without consideration of the constraint of getting data. Mm-hmm. And then let's figure out what question we can answer or can we, you know, how do we optimize getting to that question? Because it's so easy to start the other direction. I have this sample. I have this methodology available to me. What could I do with this sample and methodology? And then it's deciding on questions that may not be the important question you wanted to ask. It's just the question you think of asking because of the resources you have. If you start the other way, at least you stay focused on the question you want to answer. And then you figure out the resourcing in order to answer that question consequently.
We have known about replication challenges for quite a while. You mentioned some work from way back in the 60s. Surely by now we should have made some progress. Have you noticed any positive progress that has been made perhaps by researchers themselves or by journals in terms of adopting these guidelines that would help increase replication?
Yes, we certainly are making progress, but the evidence, whether it's working or not, and in terms of the ultimate goal of improving our research credibility and getting to new knowledge and solutions more quickly or more efficiently, that we don't have direct evidence for yet. So, but what we can say is changed in the last 10 years is there are, like, just let's refer specifically to the behaviors I mentioned at the outset, sharing data, sharing materials, pre-registration. The rate of those activities is increasing in our field over time. Surveys where you ask people, have you done this behavior, show evidence of substantial evidence of growth of the proportion of people that have done one or two or all three of those behaviors in the last 10 years. And then when you evaluate any given sample of papers, that rate is increasing, although much more slowly than whether people have done the behavior at all. So we are far from these behaviors being normative in the sense that almost every article you look at has data shared, if it can be shared, or materials available, or was pre-registered or not. And it's not clear that we'll ever get to that being true of all research or even close to all research. But the experience with it on an individual by individual basis has grown dramatically. And that suggests that at least people are trying these, seeing how they work or don't work in the context of their work, and potentially then developing new standards of practice for their work. And so that's characterized in sort of that bottom-up way of just researchers are doing this. There are also changes happening with those stakeholders, journals, funders, and institutions. And it's really the most with journals and the least with institutions so far. But the journals have been adapting their policies and practices, and there's a lot of progress there. So one of the things that the Center for Open Science, the organization that I now work in, spends its time on is promoting the TOP guidelines. These are transparency and openness promotion guidelines, which is a framework of policies that a journal or a funder or an institution can adopt of what are our expectations for data sharing, for material sharing, for pre-registration, for replication, et cetera. And those standards have been adopted by more than 5,000 journals. Psychology journals are among the leading journals for taking on the policies to promote more transparency and sharing in the research that they publish. That sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, but it simultaneously is still a minority of the total number of journals that are out there. And some of the policy adoptions are very modest, right? They do a very small amount, whereas we incrementally are hoping that they will increase those policy expectations to be more inclusive of more things that people can be transparent about. But nevertheless, culture change is hard. And so that progress is very encouraging because it provides an opportunity to make visible that norms are changing, to show high status exemplars and progressive exemplars that are making changes, that those changes aren't having negative effects, or if they are having negative effects, identifying those and then thinking about how the policy needs to be adapted to address those unintended negative consequences. And then more broadly, promoting these practices adoption by high status stakeholders, right? Journals are saying we should do this. Funders are saying we should do this. Maybe we should start doing this. So those changes are happening, but we're still at the upswing, right? It's moved into the mainstream a little bit, but you wouldn't say that these things are all universally mainstream yet, even in our field that's made a lot of changes.
Yeah, this is interesting. I remember I took a class recently by Professor Mike Frank, and one of the things that he did was he had his students do this replication project at the end of the class. And I found that to be a really neat way to introduce young researchers to these ideas and also to do some replication work, because apparently I think journals are probably disincentivized from publishing replication studies because they're not necessarily right. novel research. But I still found that to be a really great measure to like at least begin to introduce the newer generations to these ideas.
Yeah, that's critically important, is how do you integrate some of this stuff into graduate training and undergraduate instruction for that matter, so that these are part of just like learning how to, you know, analyze your data, you learn about data management and about data sharing. So those should be, if they're going to be sustainable, they have to get integrated in that way. And Mike is a great example of sort of a leading researcher that's sort of pushing on what is it that we can do to improve research practices for his own work and the collaborations that he's part of, but then also providing some vision for what's possible for others to do as well through coursework or more generally in the Many Babies Consortium, for example, that he and others have been leading.
Can you speak to any persistent challenges that we're seeing in this mission to reform science? Are there any stubborn obstacles, or is there any data to show that some certain metrics aren't being met for any reason?
Yeah, well, I'd say the biggest challenge is the inertia of the existing culture. It is hard to change. It's hard for us individually to change, and it's hard to change the research culture toward new activities, even those that we might agree, if we did agree, are desirable. And that's just a truism of culture change more generally, right? There is the inertia of the known. There is system justification, right? We want to believe that the systems that we are in are just and motivated by the right reasons. And so we have desires to defend the systems that we're in. There's the challenge of all of us that have been in this system for a while have been rewarded in the system. We know how to succeed in this system. And so change to a different one is unnerving because, oh, wait a second, that's not how I was rewarded. Or wait a second, how am I going to survive and thrive in this new way of doing things? So there's lots of that are the personal and interpersonal challenges for change. And that's all connected as well to people's knowledge of what the challenges are, right? Do people believe that these are things that need improvement, right? There's still work to do on providing the evidence that is compelling to those that are in a position to make changes in their own behavior or changes in policies to motivate new behaviors about whether change is needed. There are still barriers to not just adopting the behaviors, but knowing how to do them well. So this is a big area of frustration for people who are at the front end of the reform movement, right? It was saying, we've been needing to do this. We have to do this. We got to do this well. We have to do it now. Is recognition that becoming good at these behaviors takes time. It is not an on switch where suddenly I've only been managing data for myself and now I'm sharing it with you. It's going to be terrible, right? It's not going to be documented well because I was documenting it for me and I wasn't even planning on documenting it well for me. I documented it for the analysis as I did it. And then even when I had to return to it 6 months later for the revise and resubmit, I have no idea what that data means. Oh my God, what was variable 004? I forget. I should have really written that down. So there's just the behaviors themselves take some experience of saying, oh, okay, I'm going to be sharing my data in the future. Maybe I should create a code book that's a good code book so that I and others will understand it. And so that barrier to change is both a feeling of, oh, I don't know how to do that well, so maybe I shouldn't do it yet. But then also, I did the behavior, and then you as a reader look at it and say, oh man, you did a bad job of that. I don't have any idea what your scripts mean. And then I like, oh, well, now I feel bad because you're seeing the muck that I produced. And so part of effective reform culture requires patience isn't quite the right word, but a recognition that we're going to start doing the behaviors, and a lot of it is not going to be done in the way that we would idealize, but over time, we'll get better at it. And so part of getting better at it is giving people the space to practice and the support to get better. And that is where some of the tensions within the community get even more tense, right? We've talked about it's conceived as a crisis and a lot of people being at odds with one another on robustness of their own findings, the robustness of the field more generally. But a real challenge that is one that is a consistent one is a feeling of judgmentalism, right? Of these are behaviors that will improve your science. And if you're not all in, then you're not doing good science. And that's a destructive feeling for everybody because all of this stuff is incremental, right? Just like us learning how to analyze our data, we don't know how to do every type of analysis after our first year of graduate school. We know how to do a couple types of analyses and we build skills on top of that. All of the skills that we're talking about in terms of replicability, reproducibility are the same. And if we impose these impossible standards on ourselves or on each other, we will fail to meet them. And then we will not feel good about each other or ourselves or really create a culture of consistent improvement. And so I guess I have a wandering answer here, but you're saying, what are some of the challenges and barriers? I think the big one in the reform movement is engaging each other in a way that is critical and supportive simultaneously. Critical in saying, yeah, we can do better. And here are the things that are limits of how we're doing it now. But supportive in being respectful, engaging, and providing tools, training, information to bring everybody along on that.
So as we conclude, and to end on a more actionable note, what can we do as listeners to learn more about the open science movement, science reform communities, and other stakeholders at their front lines? As an aspiring scientist, I have, for example, been listening to and greatly enjoying the podcast called The Black Goat, hosted by, I think, Alexa, Simin, and Sanjay, all professors. I should know their last names. I have attended my first SIPS conference as well. So SIPS stands for the Society for Improvement of Psychological Science. And I know that there's a lot of other different organizations like the Center for Open Science, for which you are executive director. So could you just rapid fire plug different organizations that you know, people and thinkers to follow, and even non-conventional platforms you think are good sources of information?
Yeah, absolutely. There are lots of places to start getting into this, and it really depends on how far down a rabbit hole one wants to go. But the good thing about this is that you can do it very incrementally. Right? You can start with one thing and start to build on those. So that the chapter that we're discussing, the replicability paper for the annual review, is a good place to start just to get an overview of like what's been going on here and what are the issues and what should I care about? And there's, you know, lots and lots of references as those things tend to have. And they will, the things that sort of, oh, I want to dig deeper there, those might be places to start. And then we'll send you in all kinds of directions. There are also some really helpful primer papers to look up. Like there's one, I think it's called 7 Easy Steps to Get Started in Open Science or something like that. These are super useful because they give sort of handholds to say, where do I begin here? And they give some very concrete examples. So I would just go to Google Scholar and, you know, 7 Easy Steps into Open Science. I bet that it will come up. Or email me. I'll find it. The Society for the Improvement of Psychological Science is an organization that Simin Vazir and I co-founded, but is just a fabulous environment of mostly early career researchers, maybe 500 or so members who have an annual meeting that's all focused on improvement. What is it that we can do to make our research better? Some of that is training. So if you go to that meeting, there's a whole sequence of people offering training on power analysis, training on pre-registration, whatever it is. You could spend the entire conference going to different very practical trainings. There's also lots of discussion groups, like what we were just talking about. There's all this tension about change. How do we make this an inclusive change environment? How do we make sure that methodologies that aren't yet represented in the discussion about pre-registration or whatever get represented so that we know the extent to which these principles can be applied in those scholarly domains, or we can put on the constraints or boundaries for where they don't apply so easily. And then there are, at that meeting, there are sort of activist groups of, okay, how do you, you know, there's discussion groups of other people in my department aren't aware of these issues. How do you get a discussion started in your own department, right? Or how can we get journals to increase their expectations for this policy or that policy? So that it's a really exciting meeting for being very concrete, practical, and also change promoting. At our website, the Center for Open Science, cos.io, there's also lots of materials to try to help people get started. And I'll just note there are many, many grassroots groups, open science communities in Europe, particularly in the Netherlands and Belgium, UKRN, UK Reproducibility Network, that is obviously in the UK. There are many of these groups that have emerged that are really support communities of practice, community engagement places to just get exposure and experience in these. The last I would have recommended 4 days ago is to get on Twitter and follow people that are interested in this. But Twitter has been mayhem the last few days on these topics in hopefully long-term productive ways. But it has both the benefits of getting exposure to people and the challenges of Twitter as a medium where a lot of areas of stress can get amplified.
Thank you so much, Brian, for having us and for this fantastic conversation. I hope that this will be useful to a lot of our listeners.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on.